On April 21st of this year, 15 people were killed, 21 were injured when two teenagers opened fire at Columbine High School. It was 10 months to the day a 15-year-old killed two and injured 22 at Thurston High School. Columbine and Thurston are just two examples of schools nowhere near Champaign-Urbana, neither even in the two-state region, but not so very different from schools here. The point is, it could happen here. Those events and others like them throughout the U.S. over the last couple of years have created a flurry of interviews with child psychologists, calls for legislative action, and a desperate attempt among all of us to figure out why these shootings took place and what to do to make sure our kids' schools are safe. Right here on AM 580, you've heard commentators from a variety of fields call for possible solutions ranging from trigger locks on guns to parental liability to a total reexamination of the social structure in our public schools. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we're joined by two Illinois lawmakers. Republican Rick Winkle represents the 103rd District. Republican Tim Johnson represents the 104th. They're in town to discuss school safety. They will be in Urbana High School tomorrow night at 7 o'clock to talk with parents and other interested members of the community about how to make our schools safer. Representative Johnson's put together a brochure on the subject, which includes warning signs of troubled kids and some safety tips for parents. This hour we'll also discuss what legislative steps could be taken to ensure a safe learning environment for your children, and we welcome your thoughts on the subject. What should be done here in the state of Illinois to reduce the incidence of violence in our public schools? What kinds of regulations or perhaps legislation do you think might be effective? What can we do?
I think that's right, as Representative Winkle points out, this is a seminar, and we hope everyone attends. I certainly hope we have a good representative sampling of the community, so that Rick Winkle and I can listen. We want to hear from him.
Just to sort of get us started, just bare bones, do you believe Illinois schools right now have what you'd consider to be a fairly safe learning environment?
Well, yes and no. I mean, for either one of us to sit here and say that a Columbine couldn't happen in Illinois would be irresponsible. For us to say that we've become aware of the issue, that the Illinois State Police, that school administrations, that legislators, that law enforcement officials and police officers are aware of the problem and trying to combine efforts to solve it would also be accurate. So I think we're, I don't want to say on the cutting edge, but we certainly have made a number of steps and continue to make steps in a positive direction. But we're far from being totally immune from this sort of action or threatened action, and that's part of what we want to hear. Representative Winkle a few years ago sponsored an alternative schools bill, which at least passed and is now in force, which at least indirectly addresses some of these issues in terms of being able to provide a safer learning environment for people who want to learn and still at the same time mainlining people who might be potential or actual problems and bringing them into society and to the educational system constructively. And so I think that we have taken progressively steps over the years, but we've got a ways to go, and we want to listen, and we want to work together with the public to try to solve the problem.
Yeah, I think Attorney General Jim Ryan and Governor Ryan have both given a lot of attention to this and has resulted in through legislative action and some bills and some measures that I think are important. And among those, there's a school safety grant program. And it's a program that does have funding of about $14 million for each of 3 years in a row. Now, do all schools need to have metal detectors or things like that? Well, no, probably not. One size, certainly in this debate or this discussion, does not fit all. I mean, we have many different sorts of schools and locations and different problems of special needs that have to be addressed. And I think, again, as Tim was indicating, we need to be responsive. We need to listen. But we need to behave in reacting to it in a responsible manner, in a measured manner. And I think the Safe to Learn program does just that.
You mentioned metal detectors. How do you recommend arriving at that determination for individual schools? Is that something that should be decided district by district, or do you see there being some sort of general standard, maybe not necessarily with metal detectors, but maybe guards at the doors or something for schools across the state?
Well, I think that I don't want to speak for Tim, but I think we both have been in the past strong and continue to be strong proponents for local control. And one of the reasons for that position is that the people who are local, the people who are the school members elected locally, the school administrators on site, and the teachers and the students and the parents, they're in the best position to know. For us to impose a mandate like that, you know, mandating you have to have certain metal detectors or whatever at every school, I think that now that would be irresponsible. But by the same token, I think we're the local authorities, the local school districts have made a decision that this is a good thing. It'll enhance safety at our schools. We need it. This Safe to Learn program is a safety grant program. That's precisely why it's there. They can apply for those funds. They can access those funds and pay for the things that they need at their particular school district.
I think that's correct. If Tim Johnson or Rick Winkle were to go to the school administrators at PBL High School or Muhammad Seymour High School and say, "This is what you're going to do. You're going to install guards at all entryways to the school. You're going to have metal detectors. You're going to have a whole sophisticated and expensive set of protective measures, which may or may not be effective, and you're going to pay for it." Would be not only met with resistance, it would be met with legitimate outrage by people in those communities. We've got to reach a balance between making schools safe on the one hand and providing for continued local autonomy and a real learning environment on the other. Our goal is to not turn the schools into prisons. We've got plenty of those. We still live in a free society, and I'm not suggesting that we don't need to take steps to address these issues, because we do. But I also don't think in an attempt to politically overreact to a significant and a tragic several situations, if we react that way by wiping out the Bill of Rights, I don't think that's the solution either. The ultimate solution, which none of us are going to solve today, or even next year, or even the next 10 years, but we continue to work on, is a stronger social structure, a stronger family structure, a system of education, of parental training, and of inculcation of values in young people that hopefully can ultimately address the reason why these things happen. But in the meantime, we got to keep the school safe without making them prisons.
And I think you sort of hit on the trickiest balance of all, which is making sure that they're safe and yet also being certain that it is a comfortable environment for students.
Well, ultimately, it has to be conducive to learning. We want our teachers to teach to the highest standards, for them to be certified and retrained periodically, and not to – I'm not being critical of teachers. I'm just saying that, as in any profession, you need to keep retooling as you advance. And we want to make sure not only our students are receiving the best possible public education in the classroom, we also want to make sure that the school buildings themselves are conducive, and part of that is safety. I mean, you want to be able to know that with a high degree of confidence, a very high degree of confidence, that you're sending your children to school and they will be coming home that afternoon in the same condition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that might, and I don't mean that to be light at all, to be flippant. I mean, that's we expect safety at our schools. All we're saying is, let's not just take it for granted. Let's make sure we're being proactive so that we've got the plans that we need to have in place. And a big part of that is simply communication, partly doing what we're doing now. But the seminar, we're bringing together people from the Attorney General's office, the Sheriff's office, the Regional Superintendent's office, local superintendents, the state's attorney, Tim and I, and we're trying to create the environment of a dialogue, of people sharing ideas from the educational community, from the criminal justice community, making sure that these lines of communication are open, and of course, to the public, to the teachers, the students, the parents, making sure that staff at these schools know that there's people out there who care and who listen.
You know, public awareness has grown, but the issue is not new. The National School Safety Center, as reported in yesterday's USA Today, reports some interesting figures. In the 1992-93 school year, there were 32 students killed in school-related shootings through April 20th of that year, or through the end of the academic year. 93-94, there were 26 deaths. 97-98, there were 26 deaths. And 98-99, there have been 19. Now, I'm not saying that the problem is going away, and the fact that there were more almost a decade ago means that we don't have a problem today, that we do. We have a growing public awareness of it, and any one, let alone 32, is unacceptable. But as you can see, sometimes public awareness and legislative reaction and law enforcement reaction lags behind the reality of some of these situations.
I kind of wonder, I don't know if you have the data for this or not, how often weapons of different sorts are found at schools in Illinois.
Well, we've got some statistics. I brought some with me today. Just a quick overview, and these are kind of gruesome statistics, I guess, in a way. But during the 1997-98 school year, there were fewer school murders nationwide than in 1992-93. It's what Tim's alluding to, that the fact that this is not a new problem, but we are reducing the numbers. Obviously, they're still intolerably high. I mean, obviously, too high, but we want to eliminate these problems. The number of students kicked out of school for bringing weapons dropped by nearly a third during the 1997-98 school year. There were 3,930 students expelled for weapons violations that year. That's down from 5,724 weapons-related expulsions in 96-97. And another statistic I have here, which, you know, when we hear about these tragedies, I don't mean to diminish the significance of it, but we have 52 million students in U.S. schools. I mean, it is a very large population. And again, I mean, talking about weapons in school, and I just, you know, see parents out there just saying, oh, my God, you know, that's completely unacceptable. And it is. But by the same token, I would submit that when you ask people about safety in schools, they will tell you that their school is safe. And I think that that's they're thinking of other schools that might not be safe. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying there's not a safety problem. Obviously, there is. But by and large, I think that we're seeing the preparations that are being made here are ensuring that the high level of safety that we are enjoying will continue.
That's Illinois State Representative Rick Winkel. We're also joined here in the studio by State Representative Tim Johnson. And we welcome your questions and comments on school safety and any other topics that come to mind for you at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Gentlemen, some have argued that incidents like the shooting at Columbine point to the need for tougher gun control laws throughout the country. One thing that I really honestly haven't heard a convincing argument against is the point that if these kids didn't have access to guns, that they simply wouldn't be able to kill their fellow students. If you could find a way to get the guns out of the school, then the problem is basically solved. What's your reaction to that?
Rick, kindly showed me some action the legislature took, and it frankly didn't register when you asked the question. But we did pass a 1520 Life initiative into law this year, which is really the most comprehensive measure to target violent offenders since the creation of our Class X felony statute over 20 years ago. It's aimed at people who use guns during the commission of their felonies. And Rick can elucidate a little more on that since he was on the committee that passed the bill and was a major proponent of it. But we're addressing those issues.
Well, bottom line is if somebody uses a gun during an offense, during a violent offense, they're going to have 15 years tacked on to their sentence. If they fire the gun when they're committing the offense, they're going to have 20 years added to their sentence. Now, if they fire the gun and somebody is wounded, is hit by their gunfire, they can expect 25 years to life to be added to their sentence. So the message we want to send to the violent felon: you use a gun, you're going to spend probably the rest of your life in prison.
I think the point I'm trying to get at are in these cases, in particular with Littleton, with Columbine High School, that these kids had access to weapons through parents, other relatives. In each of these cases, there was some sort of fairly easy access, even though the parents themselves may have said, well, we keep this locked up. These kids got at it. And these may have been law-abiding citizens who had every right to own the weapons that they owned. The question is, what can other parents do about that? What can other parents do in the context of the community to make sure that kids who, you know, because most of us aren't concerned so much about our own kids, our own relatives. We're concerned about the other kids, you know, the ones we don't know, the ones that we're not comfortable with or sure about, and we don't know their parents. And what can we do as a community to try and bring these people into the community so that maybe they can be taught a little bit better about how to, you know, how to avoid having this sort of access to weapons
think
for their kids?
The operative phrase, taught a little bit better. I think education is a key approach to training kids, to teach kids about the dangers associated with guns. All too often, our kids grow up by watching TV shows where guns are used pretty routinely in very violent fashion, and they get the impression, I think, sometimes, I mean, as you hear these tragedies unfold, that they don't realize the consequences of these firearms. And I think part of it is to reach out to kids to educate them about the dangers, the real dangers that are associated with firearms, that people can be hurt.
Let's take a call. We've a caller from Urbana on line number one. Hi, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Well, good afternoon, I should say. Well, I'm pleased to hear your guests speak of the need for more educational resources. I'm a little more concerned about the implications of their answers about firearms restriction. I thought your question was rather clear. What do we do to keep the enormous numbers of firearms out of the hands of children? And I think it is strange in this society that there are more practical restrictions on my owning and operating a car than there are on owning and operating a firearm. As it happens, I am a firearms owner. And I've been watching for 30 years the very successful and incessant campaigns of the National Rifle Association and some of the more wild-eyed fanatics who insist that being a citizen of the United States ought to compel me to wear two or three firearms on all social occasions. There's too many firearms out and about. There are too many being manufactured. What do you two propose to do about it?
What do you propose to do about it?
Well, I would certainly require some of the things I require to own and operate a vehicle. I don't see why anybody should take a firearm, be able to purchase a firearm, and, for example, not demonstrate that they can use it. And I think there should be even more restrictive laws about the trade in firearms. In that regard, I would not, as a firearms owner, I would not be opposed to having a paper title required to accompany a firearm transaction the way it does a car.
Well, that's why Rick and I are having this seminar tomorrow night, and why we're on the radio here today, and why we'll be on the radio here tomorrow, is to listen to people like you who obviously have some constructive suggestions as to what we might do.
Look,
you do know that we have background checks that require a comprehensive check with respect to somebody's history of criminal behavior, mental health. The NRA itself has been an active proponent for a more comprehensive firearms education usage and training program. I'm glad that you distinguished the NRA from, quote, some of the other wild-eyed groups, because I do think that the NRA, for the most part, and I don't agree with everything they do, but for the most part, is a more responsible group. And there are some on both sides of the issue, quote, wild-eyed groups, who either want to divest everybody of guns or to make them available to everybody. And obviously neither one of those are an alternative that Rick or I are proposing. And I think, frankly, I don't think the NRA is proposing that either.
Look, what we're talking about are things that could have been done decades ago. There hasn't been a political will, and there's been a lot of confusion about it. But as a kid, when I was a kid growing up on a farm, there was a .22 rifle behind every farmhouse door that was used like a hammer for a lot of common chores.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're in a situation where somebody who owns one gun or whatever is apt to own five. And this is because of a lot of clever merchandising, because of the promulgation of a culture that in its entertainment, westerns and detective stories and what have you, suggest that a gun is a good way to handle a situation. I really think we got to get, if things continue in this vein, you guys are going to be suggesting that we have gun racks in school offices so at least the school administration can return fire.
I don't think Rick or I are making that suggestion.
You're not going to hear that from me. And I don't know, in fact, why you would suggest that.
I would suggest that, gentlemen, because you are dancing around the topic, and you both are experienced legislators. And I really doubt that either one of you has the moral character you've got moral characters, the moral fortitude to pick this issue up, especially with an election year.
Well, in an election year or a non-election year, I think both Representative Winkle and myself have never been afraid to take on difficult issues. Now, whether our solution is the same as yours is problematical. I don't know because I don't think we've been specific enough, but I don't think either one of us are dancing around the issue. Neither one of us are indicating that there isn't a problem. But if you want me to say on this radio show today that I'm in favor of legislation that bans the sale and possession of firearms, I'm not going to vote for that. So if you want me to quit dancing around the issue, the bottom line is, if there's a bill in the legislature that divests people flat out of their right to own a gun, I'm going to vote no.
Well, we thank you for that phone call, and if you would like to get in on the conversation, join us at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Representative Winkle.
Yeah, part of the problem is, and I alluded to this before, is we want to, you know, listen, of course, and be responsive, but again, there's an element of responsibility, and as Tim has suggested, to simply prohibit outright the possession of a firearm for self-protection, which is a very legitimate end, is irresponsible, in my opinion, and I would vote against that. One size obviously doesn't fit all, because when you start regulating firearms, you have to be a little careful. We represent urban people. We represent rural people. Now, let's say that you disarmed rural people and completely made their guns inaccessible in a timely way. I mean, locked them up or whatever. If you're 20 to 30 minutes away from a 911 response and you're out in the middle of the country and your home is being invaded by an armed intruder who is endangering you, your spouse, your kids, that's a tragedy too. Mm-hmm. In the making. I mean, we all want to avoid the sorts of tragedies that happen in Columbine. But let's be measured in our response. Let's be careful and not suggest that one size fits all, because about the time that you try to avoid the tragedies at Columbine, you may actually be inadvertently, unintentionally putting together all the seeds of tragedy in our rural homes when they go to protect themselves against an armed intruder, and they can't. Because we've now prevented that, or we forced them to act in a criminal manner that's contrary to the law. Some of the things that that are suggested, I think, are kind of knee-jerk in reaction, and assumes that we can somehow come up with the one right thing that solves all the problems about guns. I don't think there is such a thing.
You know, just this. Let me say to the caller, and I'm sure he was very well intended, and certainly a responsible conversation. But my colleague, Representative Winkle, who's here with me now, gave on the House floor this spring one of the most articulate and well-reasoned speeches on this whole subject matter that I've heard, essentially saying in a little lengthier and more detailed way what he said right now. And if that's a demonstration of lack of courage, then I don't know what courage is. He forthrightly said that the Second Amendment is not just limited to a well-regulated militia or hunters, But he and I both say, and he said on the House floor, and they had it quoted in the Tribune and Sun-Times and everywhere else, that there are legitimate reasons for the possession of a firearm. Not to turn the nation into Old West scenario, but legitimate reasons. We've also both been active in, and Rick's taken the leadership in, other areas of proposing solutions. The 1520 Life Bill, the Alternative Schools Bill, more money in education, social services, and others that really address the problem. And I don't think the caller is one of the these people, but some people, unfortunately, want to take a tragic situation and turn it into a springboard for a debate on a subject matter that's at best tangentially related to the issue and really begs the question. We're all here to solve this issue, but to use Columbine or Littleton or any other particular area or tragedy as a basis for divesting people of their Second Amendment rights, or au contraire, you know, arming all school administrators, neither one of which is a responsible solution, is not fair, or frankly, it's not very intellectually honest.
I do want to say, I think that when it comes to the element of our discussion of access to weapons, kids having access to their parents' weapons, to relatives' weapons, that sort of thing, that to some degree the Second Amendment does come into play. And I want to bring up just the initial idea that the caller had and just get both of your reactions to the notion that, you know, as the example that the caller made, you go in for a driver's test. You have a written test and then a vision test, and then you go out and you prove that you are capable of driving in public. What do you think would be right or wrong, in your opinion, about the same sort of idea being applied to weapons, where you would have to show through basic knowledge about weaponry, that you understand how guns work and what they can do, that you have a vision test to show that your eyesight is at a certain level so that you know what you're shooting at, and that you can exercise use of firearms appropriately, know how to dismantle a firearm if that's part of the issue. Down the road, as we maybe see more trigger locks on guns, perhaps know how to get those in position, how to put the safety on and off, things like that. What do you guys think, each one of you, about that? Is that because it doesn't necessarily restrict the Second Amendment right to a firearm? It just like driving is a privilege like any other privilege, you know, it shows that you have some understanding of what it is you're doing.
Well, I think you hit it right on the head. It's driving is a privilege, owning a firearm is a right. And there is a difference. It's not just two different words. There's a whole different legal meaning to it. And you have to be more careful in your restrictions of constitutional rights as opposed to a driving privilege. A privilege is bestowed by the state and heavily regulated, and rightly so. We do have regulations in place, and Tim's already enumerated those, that are on the books, which I support, that do regulate the use of firearms. They're on the books. And, you know, you also mentioned trigger locks. Now, you know, you look at a gun, at least in your mind, and you can see a gun, you can see the trigger, and you think, well, you know, that makes perfect sense. We'll just put a locking device on that, and we solve these problems. We had pretty conclusive evidence during the I'm on the criminal law committee in the House, and we had very convincing evidence, conclusive evidence that trigger locks, contrary to what you might conjure up in your mind, when you actually see them in real use, you can still fire the gun. Mm. And the problem with it is it gives, I think, and it would just have to, I'm not saying that never to that, but the current technology, you have to be a little careful, it gives a sense, a false sense of security that I think is very irresponsible, to give the idea that, oh, I put this lock on this gun. The parents think, oh, everything's safe and fine. My kids are safe, when maybe they're not. So you have to be a little careful which device you choose. And I know you're not just focusing simply on that, but the fact of the matter is one is a privilege and one is a constitutional right.
The tragedies that occurred or have occurred in recent years, Mississippi, Colorado, Kentucky, Arkansas, Pennsylvania, Oregon, elsewhere, That wasn't a question of somebody not knowing how to use a gun. How to use a gun. In fact, some would argue they knew how to use it too well. So that the proposal that we have a short course and a quiz on people procuring firearms is not the issue. Those people were mentally deranged. The instant background we checked that we had with respect to research of people's history of mental illness or past criminal activity makes a whole lot more sense than taking a deranged person and allowing them to have access to a firearm that they very well know how to use, properly and safely use firearms. Paul Vallandigham, who's one of Rick's and my friends, an attorney here in town, teaches, I think for no compensation, almost more time than he spends at his law practice, hunter and gun safety courses. That's what we need to be doing. But as Rick correctly points out, there's a significant difference between driving and using a gun, and I think that a responsible approach to the issue can solve all problems without creating others.
Yeah, the thing of it is, too, I think that you need to look, and that's part of what the seminar is about, is looking at, you know, signals that we have kids who maybe are troubled, that are showing signs of potentially violent behavior, disruptiveness. I think that we need to really not focus on guns. Let's focus on kids. That's what we're really talking about here. Let's focus on the children. And let's be responsive to their needs, and let's learn as the adult community, as teachers and parents and administrators, support staff, people in the community, to understand what are the warning signals. What is it that we need to be concerned about with Johnny or Susie, where they might be thinking about trying to get access? I don't think eliminating the access to a weapon is the thing. I think it's the whole notion that they want to use some kind of lethal force on a fellow human being. That's the problem, and that's why we really need to examine what are we doing in early childhood with making sure our parents are able to get their kids ready for school. What are we doing in K through 12 with programs to intervene when kids are showing these signs, when they're – and signs such as not going to school, out of school, dropping out, being disruptive when they're there, being truant, being delinquent, being otherwise, and these are statistical verifiable figures that you can, by statutory definition, you can identify who these kids are too by what they do and by what they're prone to do. And so by doing that, by focusing on these things, we should come up with or actually examine existing programs, both social and academic, the educational programs, and criminal justice programs, and in a better way coordinate existing resources in a non-conflicting way that doesn't have gaps and overlap to reach to these kids. And that's precisely what we're doing with the Youth at Risk Commission. That's House Joint Resolution 4, which I introduced, and I was honored to have both the House and the Senate pass. We just met on Monday, on the 27th. Attorney General Jim Ryan is chairing that. We've got 23 members from all the areas, social, academic, and criminal justice, and we're looking at this very thing. What happens that to make kids act out in this way, in ways that are violent, not just at school but elsewhere, but particularly at school?
I don't want to cut either one of you off, but I want to try and get to as many calls as we can with the time we have remaining. Let's go on to line number one, caller from rural Champaign. Hi.
Well, good afternoon. I may be wrong, but I believe I have in the back of my mind the memory that there was a meeting somewhere in Champaign-Urbana of just this sort that had taken place. I also seem to recall that schools were asked to develop an emergency response plan of some sort, and that all of the schools are in the state, perhaps, have worked on things of that sort. How does your proposed meeting fit with those things that have already taken place?
I think it's coincident with those meetings that have already taken place. I think you're talking about at least one meeting that I know occurred at the Urbana Middle School, maybe one at Champaign, where in the immediacy of the crisis, and legitimately, administrators and parents and others met to discuss. I think this is an ongoing continuation of the process with involvement of maybe a little more diverse group, not only parents and students and administrators and teachers, law enforcement personnel, prosecutors, legislators, and others as well. So nothing precisely like this has taken place before. But if it has, I don't think Rick or I either are going to apologize for having another one. I think that the more we can do to bring public awareness to the issue, and I hope you agree, I think that's constructive.
I was asking about coordination, and
I understand. And my hope is that there will be, and my expectation is that there will be coordination.
And second point was that schools have been asked to develop emergency response plans. Are you? Is that? Is my memory faulty? Is that something that you are aware of?
Well, sure. In fact, I think I or Tim or both of us have mentioned that, sure, there are ongoing efforts. There's no question about that at various levels, certainly at the local level, at the school district level. I know that there's efforts underway. I've read about them in the paper, and as I'm sure either you're involved directly with them or have you read too. So we're certainly aware of those and applaud those efforts and encourage their moving forward. But that's as far as Tim Johnson and I are concerned, as legislators, we want to, in a town meeting sort of fashion, a seminar that brings together the Attorney General's office, the sheriff, the regional superintendent, the superintendents, and state's attorney's offices, and makes ourselves available as an additional sounding board. So I don't see it as being duplicative. I see it as sharing a common concern and goals.
We also have both Rick and I have made available to the public and are making available various 800 hotline numbers that provide a means by which people can report risks or suspicions or other occurrences that might be the early warning signal of something like this happening. We want to elaborate on that a bit more and simply add to the process by which we attack a serious issue.
We've only got about 5 minutes left. Let's take another call. Line number two from Muhammad. Hi.
You know, I guess I have a question left over. I was not clear on what the nature of the seminar you guys were offering tomorrow night. Mainly because I came in late.
Sure,
it's on the show.
It's focusing on school safety, and what we're trying to do is make available people who are involved in the criminal justice system, the education system, and Tim Johnson and I as local legislators to make ourselves available to make a few short remarks, but more importantly to listen to parents, students, teachers, support staff, administrators, to hear their concerns and make sure that we are listening and being responsive to the concerns that people have about school safety in the community.
Okay. I have a varied background, I suppose, but one thing I've done for years is been involved, like Paul Van Landingham, in hunter safety education. And I guess the question I have for you, and I think that my position has changed somewhat over time, as I've moved from one part of the country to another, too, is there any kind of restrictive legislation on gun ownership that either one of you would support?
Yeah, we've already voted for it.
Well, I mean anything any further.
Well, I think Rick Winkle and I are both open to suggestions and ideas with respect to solutions not only to this problem but to the area of firearm violence generally. But for us to sit here and make a commitment to support some general concept without knowing what it is
well, probably no, premature. I mean, I think that that's something that is yet to be developed. I guess what I'm asking is trying to develop, I mean, is gun ownership restriction a reasonable approach to the problem?
Restriction or prohibition?
Restriction
we have now in a very significant way. I'd say Illinois is probably one of the seven or eight toughest states in the union with respect to restrictions on gun ownership.
Obviously, if you have mental health issues or if you're a convicted felon, I mean, just as two immediate examples, I mean, there's obvious restrictions there already.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. One of the I think one of the issues that's developed in my life over time has been the issue of handguns. And that's, I mean, I own guns. I've owned guns for years. I've hunted. I've competed. You know, I've done it all. But I've become increasingly concerned over time with the widespread availability of handguns to, you know, a huge segment of the population that, you know, especially kids.
You know, we can all, and I'm not debating you on this at all. I mean, you're making legitimate points, but you know, statistics, I suppose, can demonstrate anything you want according to who's interpreting the statistics. But I've yet to see any statistics to demonstrate any connection whatsoever between restrictive handgun or gun legislation or prohibition of ownership vis-a-vis crime or crimes committed with firearms. In fact, some would argue that it has a reverse relationship. I'm not going to argue that, but I will say that I've seen nothing whatsoever that would demonstrate to me that passing additional laws would do anything except make us feel good for one day and do nothing to affect the crime rate, nothing to do to affect the use of firearms and the commission of a crime. I think instead we need to be looking at mental health, our juvenile justice system, at poverty, at our civil justice system, and all the underlying causes that enter into a very complex situation.
And I'm going to give you, Representative Winkle, one last comment if you have anything else to mention along those lines, because we're quickly running out of time here.
Well, I just want to, since we're closing here, I'd really like to remind everybody that we have a school safety seminar. It's tomorrow, September 30th. It's at 7 p.m. at the Urbana High School Auditorium. We're featuring several guests from the Attorney General's Office, the Sheriff's Office, Regional Superintendent's Office, school superintendents here locally, the state's attorney. Tim Johnson and I would certainly welcome your input. In fact, we hope it's open to all, and we hope we have a big attendance.
I want to quickly mention a couple of websites that might be of interest to our listeners. One entitled When Kids Kill, and it's at www.yfiles, that's whyfiles.news.wisc, W-I-S-C as in Wisconsin, .edu, and just go to the section on school violence. The other one is the homepage of the National School Safety Center, and that's at www.nssc.org, and that has further information. My thanks very much to Illinois 103rd District Representative Republican Rick Winkle.
Thank you.
The 104th District Representative Republican Tim Johnson.